This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hello, I'm Alex Smith with a serious question for you. What if the past determines our future? Are we humans headed for success or lasting economic depression, perhaps on an overheated planet? Dr. Timothy Garrett is Associate Professor of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. In February 2010, Tim joined us on Radio EcoShock to discuss his disturbing new scientific paper. It outlined a direct relationship between the energy we burn, the wealth we create, and the growth of greenhouse gas emissions. Now he's gone a step further with some new work. So, Dr. Tim Garrett, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I do appreciate you coming on the show, and I think we're going to learn something here today. I think we should start with your original formula for energy and wealth. Can you take a shot at explaining that for the intelligent listener?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it really started just as a simple query as to where the economic value comes from. And, you know, coming from a physics background and being really totally naive in economics, I thought, well, maybe it has something to do with the rate of energy consumption by civilization. In other words, perhaps that our wealth, the wealth of civilization, has a direct link to how much energy we can consume. To me, that seemed like a reasonable assumption, because in order for us to do anything, which I suppose is perhaps a measure of our wealth, we need to consume energy. That's a basic law of the physical universe. It is through energy transformations that anything happens. And so what I tried to do was just simply look at this using some available data, and it turned out that this relationship is in fact fixed, that there is a constant relationship of about 10 milliwatts that is required to support every inflation-adjusted $1990 of economic value. And that was the core result of the first paper I did into this, and what I tried to do is go from there to see what this implied for subjects such as global warming, which are closer to my primary field of research in atmospheric sciences.
Well, based on everything we know so far, if we grow the economy, as every politician promises, we'll put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But what if the economy crashes? Will we put less up there, or will we reach safe levels if we have a severe downturn?
Well, this is where my work differed slightly from perhaps what other people are thinking. Now, the way I define wealth is that it is the accumulation of our past production of economic value. So what we have today is an accumulation of what we've been able to do in the past. Now, when you talk about the economy declining, well, usually what people think about is they think about GDP going down, the gross world product declining with time. And what I showed was that if the GDP declines with time, which is ordinarily what we would think of as being a depression, this would not, in fact, correspond to lower carbon dioxide emissions. In fact, carbon dioxide emissions would need to grow. Instead, in order for carbon dioxide emissions to go down, what would be required is effectively a complete collapse of the economy. A collapse in the sense that the gross world product would have to be almost completely offset by inflation. So that, in some sense, it would seem strange to an economist to think about this, but in some sense, the global product would have to be negative rather than positive. In other words, we'd have to be in a situation of net consumption rather than net production. We are consuming more of what we have produced in the past rather than producing new, increasing wealth. So that's a rather extreme situation, but this is what the data bears out as being required to have lower carbon dioxide emissions.
So if I understand it correctly, your definition of wealth does not include the sort of fantasy money that, like the quantitative easing from the U.S. Federal Reserve, but it includes everything that humans have produced that's still here from the beginning of time. I mean, even the Pantheon in Rome would be part of our accumulated wealth at this point.
Yes, yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, I part of my wealth is my house, but the house was produced back in 1926.
And you have a new paper submitted to the journal Climatic Change, and the title is On the Coupled Evolution of Inflation, Wealth, and Atmospheric Concentrations of Carbon Dioxide. And you do go a step further here, predicting, it seems to me, almost the worst of all worlds, high levels of greenhouse gases and inflation. I still don't really get what inflation has to do with climate change.
I was actually just down in New Orleans for a scientific meeting, and I spent some time after that with my family. And we went to some local museums, and of course in New Orleans, you know, there's the lasting legacy of the Hurricane Katrina disaster. And with Katrina, as it was with, you know, perhaps all natural disasters are, historically, they've been inflationary. What they do is they destroy past production while people perhaps still have the dollars in their pockets, but there are fewer things available for their dollars to be matched to, so the cost of what is present goes up in value. I mean, as it goes up in cost. Now, this wasn't actually how I approached it in the paper, but I think this was how an economist would normally approach the topic. The way I approached it in the paper was that I showed that environmental destruction, whether it's by disease or by weather or whatever it is effectively a decay on our past production that devalues what we have, and that is effectively an inflationary pressure. Now, what you can think about global warming being is, in some sense, it's like a long-term natural disaster. It is not only a long-term natural disaster that happens continuously, unlike Katrina, which was momentarily, but it also happens globally. So with Katrina, it was instantaneous, effectively instantaneous, and it caused a short-term inflation. But then people were able to come in from outside and provide new resources that stabilized the New Orleans economy. Now, I was in New Orleans, things were expensive still, but, you know, it wasn't out of this world. But in a future world, you can imagine, now, this is slightly speculative, but it's consistent with what you would expect from the physics. You could imagine that there is an ever-increasing environmental pressure on civilization that continually acts as an ever-stronger force that eats away at what we have produced in the past. And this will be an inflationary pressure that cannot be supplanted by outside resources from outside, because it is acting globally. It will be affecting everybody.
Right. If we have rising seas, for example, eating up some of our best farmland or salinating it, there's just, you can't make some more land like that. It's gone.
Exactly.
So that pushes up the price of all the remaining land, and that's how climate change can create inflation, for example.
Yes.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Timothy Garrett, an atmospheric scientist from the University of Utah. And I'd like to really get to the conclusions of your new paper. Based on our past records of energy use and wealth, what does your model show as possible futures?
Well, in fact, I mean, this was actually stimulated by our past conversation. In my first study, I showed that carbon dioxide emissions and wealth were intrinsically coupled. Without actually decarbonizing the economy, like switching to renewables or nuclear power at an extraordinarily fast rate, you cannot have wealth without having carbon dioxide emissions. The two go together. And in fact, since 1970, the relationship between the two has been very, very tightly fixed. Now, that would seem to have implications for the future, because carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere. As carbon dioxide emissions accumulate in the atmosphere, some fraction goes into what we call sinks in the oceans and the land, but about half of what we emit accumulates in the atmosphere. That is going to create an ever-increasing pressure on civilization. Now, by eating away at civilization wealth, global warming will actually reduce our capacity to emit carbon dioxide. So there's actually what you would call in physics a negative feedback. So our wealth is emitting CO2. CO2 accumulates in the atmosphere and then feeds back on our capacity to produce new wealth. Eventually, one could imagine that civilization would enter into a phase of collapse because the carbon dioxide levels are so high that we're simply unable to produce new goods without them being destroyed by global warming. And at that point, perhaps emissions would go down, and eventually, if civilization collapsed fast enough, then perhaps carbon dioxide concentrations would be stabilized. Now, you asked me last time what would be required to keep carbon dioxide concentrations at 450 parts per million, and that's normally what's considered to be about a dangerous level by, let's say, during the Copenhagen Accord. And I made a guess that it would require actually flat-out civilization collapse, and based on some preliminary work I did, and then I decided to look into this a bit more deeply, and I actually wrote a second paper where it turns out that is true. Not only would we have to have civilization collapse starting very, very soon, like within the next decade or so, but we would also have to have extremely rapid decarbonization in order to keep carbon dioxide levels below, let's say, 500 parts per million, twice pre-industrial levels. In order to keep them below 1,000, well, without civilization collapse, let's say we have continuing health, let's say that the civilization is very resilient to global warming, then carbon dioxide levels are going to go extremely high by the end of the century, probably above 1,000 parts per million. You think about 1,000 parts per million, well, that's probably, depends on what the climate sensitivity is, but that's something along the lines of 5 degrees Celsius warming at least. And when we think of 5 degrees Celsius warming, people are familiar with this, usually start bringing up highly catastrophic scenarios. So in some sense, it's hard to imagine how civilization cannot be in pretty dire straits during this century.
Well, I hear people suggesting that we could make a big cut in carbon emissions just with energy efficiency. We'll all get electric cars and we'll put in the light bulbs. And I've heard that you don't think so much about energy efficiency as a way to save ourselves.
Well, actually, it's almost counterintuitive, but no, in fact, it's the other way around. The whole reason that civilization has been so successful and has grown so quickly is that we are energy efficient. It is our efficiency of taking material goods and energy and converting them into production and net growth that actually leads to us producing carbon dioxide. The increasingly efficient we become, the more efficient we become at growing civilization and its wealth. I think this is actually common sense. I mean, we always strive for efficiency because we have some underlying sense that efficiency is good for our general well-being. But our general well-being is normally measured in terms of economic wealth. And as I showed, economic wealth has a direct correspondence to carbon dioxide emissions. So increasing energy efficiency leads to more energy consumption, and more energy consumption leads to more carbon dioxide emissions. And I'm not the first person to say this. This has actually been pointed out by energy economists ever since the late 1800s. So I'm not sure why it's not more generally accepted today.
Just on a personal level, I have a camper van, but I don't drive it to Mexico anymore because I don't want to put all those carbon emissions up there. But if it got 100 miles to the gallon, well, maybe I'd drive further. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
Oh, of course, yeah. No, it's like the beer fridge in the basement. No, I just bought one of those because my upstairs fridge is actually fairly efficient these days.
You know, the study of economy has been called the dismal science, and your paper might qualify for that title. The abstract reads, "There are no plausible thermodynamically supported solutions that avoid inflation rates less than 100% and lead to stabilized atmospheric CO2 concentrations within this century." To me, that says we either get worthless money or a dangerous atmosphere or both. Are these our choices?
I don't see any other options. I mean, I suppose what you could argue is that civilization could decarbonize, switch to renewables and nuclear power at such an extraordinarily fast rate that in some sense we decouple ourselves from the atmosphere. So in other words, we are able to keep consuming energy without affecting atmospheric composition. But even there, there's actually, I mean, in some sense it's rather amusing, well, it's intellectually amusing at least, that decarbonizing civilization will actually not be as effective as one might expect. Now, decarbonizing civilization, let's say we were to do this proactively, presumably it would cost money, and we would only do it with the expectation that it would help alleviate the worst damages of global warming. And I think that makes sense. You know, why would we do it otherwise? We would put in the effort because it will benefit us in the long run. But remember, anything that benefits us in the long run is effectively measurable as an increase in our wealth. And an increase in our wealth will translate to an increase in energy consumption. So, in essence, what happens is decarbonizing promotes our wealth and our energy consumption in the future. But increasing our energy consumption, as long as we are partly a fossil fuel economy, will correspond to increasing fossil fuel carbon dioxide emissions. So this doesn't completely offset the decarbonization gains, but because it promotes society health, we actually do not gain as much from decarbonizing as one might initially expect, because it's a dynamic system and we would actually continue to grow faster than we would otherwise.
I can see it. I mean, if we build a lot of nuclear power plants, it's going to take some carbon shovels to get all that cement going, and all the materials still have to be brought out. We're going to use oil to do it. And so there might actually be a burst of new emissions just trying to do that.
Well, yeah, there's that too, yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, recently I recorded a speech by the former Whole Earth catalog guru, Stuart Brand. He calls for an all-out effort to geoengineer the planet to stave off a climate disaster. He likes the idea of making clouds brighter by shooting seawater into them. That's supposed to reflect more sunlight, hoping to cool the Earth. You are a scientist with expertise in clouds. What do you think about that?
I'm quite skeptical that that would work. I mean, geoengineering is, in some sense, it may be a question not whether we should do it, but perhaps when we will do it. Because one could imagine that civilization will always try to do whatever it can to optimize its capacity to grow. But with regards to brightening clouds, well, that's been suggested as perhaps a viable way of doing it. One popular way that's been suggested is to produce lots of sea spray from some fancy ships. This sea spray goes up into the clouds, and that makes them brighter because if there are lots of small aerosol particles, these sea salt particles, then there will be more droplets in the clouds and also smaller droplets. And that has two effects. One is that, for some reasons I won't describe, it makes the clouds brighter. Just by having a large number of small droplets, you have brighter clouds than clouds that have a small number of large droplets. But it also tends to shut off precipitation in the clouds. And because precipitation is a sink, it's a means for losing water from clouds, it has been argued that the clouds will have longer lifetimes and therefore reflect more sunlight to space for a longer period of time. And because they're brighter, they'll reflect more. These ideas have been around since the 1970s and 1980s. And it has since become apparent to a lot of researchers in this area that the effect is not nearly as strong as one might initially expect. There are all sorts of, again, negative feedbacks. And these negative feedbacks often act to entirely erase the brightening effect that you might expect from these aerosols going into the clouds. I mean, just to give one example, the clouds that would be targeted are these large sheets of stratus clouds that and stratocumulus clouds that are off the western coasts of continents. So where you are, I guess you're in Vancouver, are you? You're probably very familiar with low-level clouds. I used to live in Seattle, and it was, you know, in Seattle, it's, the entire winter was covered with this large deck of low-level clouds. Now, these clouds, if we brighten them, then they tend to be over the ocean. If we brighten them, then less solar radiation comes in to heat up the surface. And it is warming of the surface that enables the fluxes of moisture and heat from the oceans and the surface upwards into the atmosphere that enable the clouds to form in the first place. So let's say the clouds become brighter, they cool the surface, then there's less flux of heat and moisture to form the clouds, and then the clouds dissipate. So it could be that adding aerosols to clouds does not make them brighter and more long-lived, but actually shorter-lived and darker.
You know, you're kind of a troublemaker in a way here. Because we've got a lot of people who are looking for a realistic way out of this awful dilemma, and you've got a really sharp mind that seems to be you can stick some pins in the balloon and away it goes. But I guess that really is what science is about. I mean, we're looking for what is real and what works and what doesn't.
Oh, of course. I mean, you know, these are interesting physics problems. And, I mean, one of the privileges of, you know, being a university scientist is, of course, that, I don't know, you get to think about these problems for the simple joy of thinking about them. And if the answers end up one way or rather than the other, well, that's, well, so be it. I mean, it's the joys in trying to figure something out. Yeah, I mean, that's for me, that was the fun of doing the economics problem. I mean, I have no background in economics, but I am as much a player as anybody else in the economic system. And wouldn't it be fun if it is possible to understand the economic system using the tools that, well, I, as a physicist, understand from my research in doing clouds?
Well, as we've just found out, the economists don't understand the economy either. Look, our guest has been Dr. Timothy Garrett, Associate Professor, Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. He's been researching the relationships between energy, wealth, and greenhouse gas emissions. Tim, people seem really enthusiastic about your work, even though it shows us playing right into some kind of end game. Isn't that strange?
You know, I don't know how much enthusiasm there really is, but I mean, it's, you know, I think that in a lot of ways, people have some sort of hunch that things like energy efficiency actually leads to more energy consumption. And we hear this, you know, repeated mantra that it leads to less energy consumption. But I think, you know, we always think that energy efficiency increases our ability to lead wealthy, happy lives. And I don't know, wealthy, happy lives tends to correspond to increased energy consumption. So I think, you know, some people are just more receptive to really fairly intuitive, obvious ideas. And perhaps another perspective, you know, maybe this is a very cynical statement, but if things really truly are hopeless, well then, you know, we don't have to worry as much. We can just enjoy the present.
Let's party like it's 1999. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Tim Garrett.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.